Shivering, she closed her eyes and breathed in the night, listening to its faint sounds, to its soft voice. She was at peace there, alone on the top of the Druid's Keep, her fortress, her world. She had won it, and she would keep it. Those who could help her might do so, but they had better know their place. In the morning, Garen Sarah would address the council. Ostensibly, he was to speak to the state of the Four Lands and the role of the Druids in monitoring its vicissitudes. But the true purpose of his speaking was to make clear that he was now allied with her, had become her consort, her shadow self. He would do so thinking to impress upon the listening Druids that he had gained control of her. None would believe it. It didn't matter what he said or did. None would believe. If they did, they had better not let her find out. Chapter 7. It was late in the day when Swiftsure sailed out of the shadows enfolding the dragon's teeth toward the brightly lit towers of Paranor, sharp-edged and spiraling against a horizon colored crimson and gold by the setting sun. Beck worked the rigging and sails in preparation for their arrival, while Rue stood in the pilot box, easing the big ship into position. It was a still, windless day, and sailing her required little in the way of skill, her steady progress reliant mostly on the power fed out of the diapsin crystals. The journey had taken barely 48 hours, the weather clear and uncomplicated, the voyage made by flying day and night, the senior Ohmsfords taking turns at catching a few quick hours of sleep when needed. It was a schedule they were used to, having followed it on numerous occasions when there were weather reasons to do so. They might have anchored and slept in this instance, but both were anxious to get to their destination and find out the truth about Penn. Of one thing they were quite certain, Trant Rowan was holding something back, and whatever it was, it had everything to do with why they had been summoned. Beck glanced over to where the druid sat on a viewing bench with his back against the foremast and his safety line cinched tightly about his waist. He was not comfortable in the air, so he had spent much of his time in that position. He was friendly, though. He was more than willing to talk whenever they approached, always amenable to a discussion of the facts surrounding the disappearances of Grian and Penn, seemingly anxious to help them find their family. Yet, as Beck had observed at the start of this journey, it was what Trant Rowan didn't say as much as what he did that kept giving him away. There was no mention still of why the druids had decided to go in search of Tagwyn after his departure from Paranor, or why that pursuit had led them to Penn. There was no mention of what had become of the troll guard that had served his sister so faithfully from the beginning of her term as Ard Rhys. Most important of all, he offered no suggestion as to what might have happened to Grian. Beck was aware that he might be overreacting to omissions that were nothing more than oversights on the part of a distraught messenger, omissions easily explained once broached. But Beck had always trusted his instincts on such things, and his instincts in this case warned him that something was not right. Because Rue felt the same way, he was inclined to keep his concerns to himself and to watch his back until he had a better understanding of what had happened. As Swiftsure settled down inside the broad west court, where the druid airships were anchored when not flying, it occurred to him that he had been to Paranor only twice before in his life. It was a shock to realize that he had not come more often than that, given that Grian had been Ard Rhys for almost 20 years. But he understood the reason for it. Both times he had visited, he had been anxious to leave. The walls of the keep closed in on him, shut him away and gave him a trapped and helpless feeling. The stone passageways reminded him of the underground lair of the Antrax. The dark forms of the druids reminded him of the Morgor and his Mwelrets. His time in Parcasia still haunted him, its memories unpleasantly vivid and troubling. His sister had been anxious to explain what it was she was trying to achieve with the Order, how she envisioned it serving the Four Lands. It was Walker Bowe's dream she was seeking to fulfill, and she had dedicated her life to making it come true. But it was her vision she was following, not Bex, and he had trouble finding reasons to believe in it as she did. He did not share Walker's belief in the importance of the druids to the races. He did not accept that a druid council would function any more effectively or wisely than the governments already established. He trusted his sister and believed her to be capable and committed, but she was still only one person, and however powerful she might think herself, she was diminished measurably by how she had lived her life as the Ill's Witch. Her exposure to the truth of who and what she was through contact with the Sword of Shannara had caused her psyche to suffer great damage. She might have woken from the coma into which she had fallen as a result of having faced up to that truth, but he wasn't sure she had come back from it whole. Her responsibilities were so overwhelming, and the response of those she sought to help so disdainful, that he found himself wondering whether she might revert to the dark creature she had been before he found her. He hated himself for thinking that way, but he understood the pressure she was under and the weight of the task she had given herself. It was one thing to re-establish the Druid Order. It was another to lead it. He wanted to tell her to let go, to come away with him, even while she was explaining what it was she was trying to do. He wanted to urge her to stop. But in the end, he said nothing. It was her life, not his. It was her decision. Standing on the foredeck of the Swiftsure as Rue set the big airship down on Druid soil, he found himself wondering if he would ever see Grian again. His concerns had all been for Pen, but it was Grian who had disappeared first and been gone longest. Because she had a history of such disappearances, and because she had always returned from them, he had given little thought to what the most recent one might mean. But it was possible, even for an Ard Rhys, to venture too far into unfriendly territory and not be able to find a way out again. It was possible, even for Grian, not to return. He turned his attention to dropping the anchor lines then, as the airship touched the ground, climbing down the rope ladder to secure them. The air within the druid walls felt hot and still. He smelled the dust and the dryness. He could breathe them in. Already he was wishing he were somewhere else. Taking a deep breath to calm himself, he waited for Rue and Trant Rowan to descend. It was pointless to dwell on his discomfort. He was here, and here he would remain until he found what he had come looking for. With Rue beside him, he followed the druid toward a pair of massive double-entry doors at one end of the court, but before they reached them, the doors opened and a small group of black-cloaked figures emerged into the fading light. As they moved into the courtyard, their long shadows played against the earth like wraiths, faceless and bodiless within their coverings. A chill went up Beck's spine, a warning to be careful. He had formidable magic at his command, but his skills and experience were not the equal of these. As the contingent approached them, Trant Rowan turned back to Beck and Rue. "Your arrival is much anticipated," he said with a deferential nod. There were three of them, two leading the third, one of the two, a broad-shouldered woman of some size and obvious strength. She pulled back her hood as she reached him, and he knew instinctively from the strong features and military bearing that she was the leader. "Beck Ohmsford," she said, extending her hand. "I am Shadea Aru, Ard Rhys in your sister's absence." She shook his hand quickly, took Rue's in turn, then nodded to her companions. "My first of order, Garen Sarah, and my assistant, Pison Wentz." Beck nodded to them in turn, the first tall, thin, and sharp-featured, the second physically unintimidating, but with eyes that reminded him of a hunting bird's. Deferring to the woman, neither spoke on being introduced. "What have you learned of our son?" Rue asked at once. "Have you found him?" "We haven't." Shadea met her gaze without flinching, something a lot of men couldn't do. "We continue to search, of course, for both your son and the Ard Rhys, but we have run out of places to look. If you come with me, I will explain." Without waiting for their agreement, she turned and started back toward the keep, her two companions and Trond Rowan falling quickly into step behind her. Beck glanced at Rue, shrugged, and they followed as well. He was trying to remember if his sister had ever said anything about any of these druids, but nothing came to mind. Aside from Arryn Elysadil, Tagwyn was the only one he could remember her speaking about, and the only one he could remember meeting. He wished now that he had paid better attention. Inside the keep, Shadea beckoned them forward to walk with her, and the other three druids gave way as they moved ahead. The Ard Rhys disappeared after retiring to her chamber several weeks ago. She went into her room and never came out. There was no sign of a struggle when we found her missing. The trolls on watch said she had not come out during the night and that they had heard nothing. I dismissed them anyway, simply as a precaution. We have many enemies, and they have many reasons to want us gone. The trolls might have been subverted. That was one explanation, Beck thought, though it didn't feel right. I recall my sister saying more than once how much she depended on them, how reliable they were. Shadea's sun-browned face turned his way sharply, and she brushed the short-cropped blonde hair from her forehead. She may have made a mistake by trusting them. We don't know. No one has seen her since? No one has sent any word of her? None. Tagwyn seemed to have an idea about what might have happened, but then he disappeared as well. We tracked him to Emberyn and to Arryn Elysadil. Then we tracked them both to Patch Run. Apparently, when they left, they took your son with them. That was the last thing we discovered that's worth talking about. We still don't know why the Ard Rhys disappeared or where she might have gone. We don't know where your son, Tagwyn, and Arryn Elysadil have gone either. Our airships continue to search, but time slips away, and that doesn't favor our efforts. I am hopeful that by coming to Paranor, you can change things. Beck felt Rue's hand tighten in his own. How can I help you? I don't know anything about this. Shadea Aru nodded. It is no secret that you are extraordinarily close to your sister. The story of how you found each other 20 years ago is common knowledge. Your inherited magic drew you in ways that nothing else could. It binds you irrevocably. I think we can make use of that in finding her, and very likely your son as well. I'll show you how. They passed down the shadowed corridor and ascended a series of stairs to the upper levels. In a broad, high-ceilinged hall that ran down the center of the keep, they encountered other druids moving about in small groups, carrying books and papers and conversing with one another. A few looked them over as they passed, taking note of the two who were clearly not of their order. But no one looked for very long, turning quickly away when they caught sight of Shadea. They are afraid of her, Beck thought. He remembered that it had been the same when he had come to visit his sister. The same looks, the same quick averting of faces when she passed. Nothing had changed in her absence. It made him wonder if it was the nature of the position or of the candidates drawn to occupy it. It made him wonder why anyone would want it. As they turned down a secondary passageway, one narrower and less heavily traveled, a young druid rushed into their midst, colliding with Beck in a flurry of confusion and knocking him to the floor. Sorry, he apologized quickly, reaching down to help Beck up again. The papers he had dropped lay scattered everywhere about them. I didn't see you. I was in a hurry. My mistake. Are you all right? Well then, again, sorry. Their hands clasped, and Beck felt a tiny piece of paper pressed into his palm. There, no harm done, the young druid declared, his eyes meeting Beck's quickly before looking away. He apologized again, this time to Shadea, and bent to retrieve his papers from the floor. The big woman gave him a withering look and walked right on past, beckoning the others to follow. Beck glanced down briefly at the young druid as he passed him. The other man did not look up. As they continued on, Beck slid the piece of paper into his pocket. He had never seen the young druid before. He glanced over at Rue, but she didn't seem to have noticed anything. They climbed several sets of stairs and traversed several more corridors before coming to a room set high in the keep. Gnome hunters stood watch without, and the door was locked and barred. The gnomes moved aside quickly as Shadea stepped up and manipulated the locks. When the door was open, the druids ushered the Ohmsfords inside. Beck glanced around. The room was empty except for a huge basin of water that sat at its center. The basin bowl was shallow and broad, and the waters it contained were a very deep green. There were lines and markings drawn on the surface of the basin below the waters, bumps and ridges as well. It was a map, he realized, moving over to get a closer look. A map of the four lands. This is where you can help us, Beck, Shadea Aru announced, moving up beside him. Rue had already taken up a position on his other side, and he could feel the anticipation radiating from her like body heat. This room is called the Cold Chamber. The stone walls insulate the basin. The scry waters in the basin monitor the lines of power that bind the earth. They reflect disturbances in those lines when a powerful magic is used. We study them in an effort to discover where magic is being used outside the purview of the Order. She turned to him. We had thought to use the scry waters to track your sister's movements after she disappeared, but there have been no disturbances that would indicate the use of her magic. Still, the waters will track such magic, even its most minuscule application, if their power to interpret is enhanced. If you were to apply the magic of the Wish Song to that end, we might be able to discover where she is. I know you possess the power to control its effect on things. Will you use it here? Beck held her gaze a moment, trying to read what was behind it. She was asking him to do something very straightforward, but he was suspicious of her motives. Trant Rowan's omissions and shadings still troubled him. His uneasiness about the circumstances surrounding the disappearances of his sister and son hadn't lessened. He was tired from lack of sleep and worry, and he didn't trust that he was thinking clearly. I know you want me to do this right away, he told her. I want that too. But I don't know that I can help you effectively until I'm better rested. Application of the magic of the Wish Song requires a steady concentration that I don't feel I can bring to bear just now. What I would like to do is eat something and get some sleep, then try in the morning, when I'm fresh. Beck! Rue exploded angrily, gripping his shoulder so hard it hurt. This is our son and your sister we are trying to help. What do you mean you need to rest? You can rest later. Her words made him flinch, but he looked directly at her. I'm worried for them too, but I don't want to make a mistake. I'm just not sure I'm recovered enough from that fever to focus the way I need to. Not without a little food and rest first. He turned away from the surprise and confusion that flashed sharply in her eyes. Tomorrow, then? Clearly unhappy with the delay, Shadea Aru took a moment to consider. Reluctantly, she nodded. Tomorrow will be fine. Trant Rowan will see you to your sleeping chambers and arrange for food to be brought. Rest well. She swept out of the room without sparing him another glance, a hint of disgust reflected on her strong features. The taller of the two druids who went with her turned briefly to study him, and Beck did not care for what he saw in the dark eyes. Then they were gone, and Trant Rowan was saying something about arrangements for the night. Beck didn't hear all of it. His attention was back on Rue, who was looking at him in what he hoped was a less judgmental way.
Come with me, the druid ordered, his own face dark and troubled.
It took them only a few minutes to reach their sleeping chambers, which consisted of two rooms with a bed, a few furnishings, a single door, high windows, and a pair of unfriendly-looking gnome hunters already positioned at the doors.
To keep you safe, Trant Rowan explained quickly. We are taking no chances with your family, even here. Until we find out what has happened to the Ard Reese and your son, we intend to keep close watch over all of you. I will have dinner sent right up.
When he was gone and the door securely closed behind him, Beck put a finger to his lips before Rue could say anything, shaking his head in warning. He motioned about the room, to the walls and ceiling, to the vents and doors and windows, where other ears might be listening. When she nodded her understanding, he took her in his arms and put his lips close to her ear.
"Are you all right?"
He felt her nod into his shoulder, her mouth pressed against his ear.
"What was all that about a fever? You haven't had a fever in months."
"An excuse to keep Shadea at bay,"
he whispered.
"Something about all this isn't right. I need to think about what she's asking me to do."
Another nod.
"I don't trust her either. I don't trust any of them. They're lying about something."
"That young druid who bumped into me in the hallway? That wasn't an accident. He gave me a note. I have it in my pocket. He pressed it into my hand while he was helping me get up. He didn't want Shadea and the others to see what he was doing. He took a big chance."
"Do you know him? Is he Grian's friend?"
"I don't know who is or isn't her friend at this point."
"Have you looked at the note?"
He shook his head.
"I was waiting until we got away from the others. I didn't want to take a chance that they might see me looking at it."
He paused, looking past her to the stone walls.
"Walk with me over to the window. Stand close so we can shield what we're doing."
He felt her hand press against his back.
"Do you think they might be watching as well as listening? Here?"
He shook his head. He didn't know. But he wasn't about to chance it. The safety of his sister and his son were at stake, and some among the druids might not have their best interests at heart, no matter what they said. They moved over to the window. The sun was setting on the horizon, a blood-red orb hung against a cerulean sky. Shadows had lengthened into dark pools, and the moon was just visible along the northeast horizon. The air outside felt cool and fresh on their faces as they leaned out, resting their arms on the stone sill, hunched close together with their backs to the room. Beck slipped the scrap of paper from its hiding place and laid it in front of them, keeping his hands cupped about it. They bent close. Four words were printed on it in block letters. "Do not trust them." That was all. Beck studied the note a moment more, glanced at Rue, then pocketed it anew. When he had a chance to do so, he would destroy it, but he would have to be careful how he handled it. Druids could reconstruct messages from nothing more than ashes.
"Clearly not everyone is in agreement about what has happened to my sister," he said. "The young druid, for one."
"Maybe others as well."
He laid his hand on her arm.
"We can't trust anyone."
She nodded, her eyes shifting to find his.
"What are we going to do?"
He smiled. "I was hoping you could tell me." He leaned over and kissed her forehead gently.
"I really was."
In bed that night, wrapped in each other's arms, comforted by the darkness and the silence, they talked about it.
"Do you think they are listening still?"
She said it with an edge to her voice that suggested what she might do to them if she discovered they were. He stroked her hair.
"I think they have better things to do."
"I hope they weren't watching when we bathed. That makes my skin crawl. But I can imagine that ferret-faced druid doing it."
"No one watched us bathe."
She was silent a moment, pressed up against him.
"At least the meal they gave us was decent. They didn't try to poison us."
"They have other plans for us. Poison doesn't figure into things until we've served our purpose."
He felt her face turn toward his own in the dark.
"Which is?"
"You have a hunch, don't you?"
His voice was already a whisper, but he lowered it further.
"I've been thinking about it. Grian disappeared for no discernible reason, but Tagwin went outside the order to find help. That suggests he didn't know who to trust among these druids any more than we do. He knew he could trust Arryn, though, so he traveled to Emberyn to ask for his help. Arryn would have given it willingly, that much I feel pretty certain about."
"Me too."
"But then they went to Patch Run.
Maybe they did so to look for us, but they found Penn instead. So they asked Penn where we were. He probably told them and wanted to go with them. Somehow he persuaded them that it was a good idea. Or they had to take him because they thought he was in danger.
Right. But what happened then? Did they come looking for us?
If they did, why didn't they find us? Penn would have been able to track us down. He would have known how. Aaron would have helped him, using druid magic. Anyway, something happened to prevent that, so now these druids who've brought us here are looking for them, and ostensibly, at least, for Grian as well. But they can't find them.
They want us to find them, Rue whispered. They want us to do their work for them, but maybe not to help. Maybe to do harm.
It made sense. While the druids might profess that their intentions were honorable, there was good reason to think otherwise. They were silent again for a time, pondering their fresh insight, trying to think through what they should do about it. Beck felt his wife tighten her grip on him.
We can't help them. We can't put Penderin in any more danger than he is already in.
I know.
I hate it that he's become involved in this, in your sister's life, in druid intrigues and gamesmanship.
Don't underestimate Penn. He is smart and capable, and he has some experience in the world. He might not have magic to protect him, but he has his wits. Besides, if he's with Aaron, he's as protected as he would be with us.
I wouldn't agree with that. Anyway, he shouldn't have to be protected in the first place.
He felt her anger building.
Rue, listen to me. We can't change what's happened. We don't even know for sure what that is. That's what we came to find out. Maybe we will, once we have a chance to talk with that young druid. In the meantime, it doesn't do us any good to get too angry to think.
What makes you think I'm angry?
Well,
don't you think I have a right to be angry?
Well,
are you suggesting I can't be angry and think at the same time?
He hesitated, uncertain of his reply, then felt her begin to shake with suppressed laughter.
Very funny, he whispered.
She poked him in the ribs.
I thought so.
They lay quietly, listening to each other breathe. Beck ran his hands along his wife's ribs and down her legs. He could feel the ridges where scar tissue had formed over wounds she had suffered 20 years earlier aboard the Jarl Shannara. They were a testimony to her strength and resiliency, a reminder of how hard her early life had been. He had always believed her to be stronger than he was, tougher of mind and body both. He had never stopped thinking of her that way. Others might think that because he possessed the use of the Wish Song's magic, he was the stronger. Some might even think that being the male in their partnership made him the stronger. But he knew better.
I won't get angry until after I get Penderin back, she said suddenly, her words so soft he could barely hear them. I don't make any promises after that.
I wouldn't expect it.
We will get him back, Beck. I don't care what it takes.
We'll get him back.
How?
You asked me that earlier.
You didn't answer.
I was thinking. I'm still thinking.
Well, hurry up. I'm worried.
He smiled at her insistence, but was glad she couldn't see him doing so. She was scared for her son, and he would not want her to mistake how he was treating the matter. He was worried, too, but he understood that what was needed was a calm, measured approach to untangling the puzzle surrounding Penn's and Grian's disappearances. Rue's strength might lie in her determination, but his lay in keeping his wits.
I'll hurry, he promised.
I would appreciate that.
I know.
I love you.
I love you too.
Minutes later, they were asleep. Chapter 8. Beck and Rue were awake early, troubled enough by the challenges that lay ahead that the first inklings of light in the east were sufficient to bring them out of their fitful sleep. They washed and dressed and found breakfast waiting outside the door in the form of bread, cheese, fruit, and cold ale. When they retrieved the food tray, the hallway was deserted save for the gnome hunters, who were stationed across the hallway. Beck nodded agreeably, but got no response. "I don't think we are guests in the usual sense of the word," he told Rue as he closed the door. Within an hour, Trant Rowan was knocking, his eyes bright with anticipation.
"Are you ready to try now, Beck?" he asked.
Beck was. He had a plan, although he hadn't confided it to Rue. He told her when they woke that he knew what to do, but that it was better if he kept it to himself. Her own response should not seem forced or planned. She must trust him even if it looked like he was doing something he should not. He understood what was needed. No one at Paranor could be trusted with Penn's or Grian's whereabouts. If he was lucky enough to discover that information, it belonged to them, and them alone. He had explained it all in a whisper as they lay together in the deep gloom of early dawn, still wary of who might be listening, determined to make no mistake that would reveal their true intentions. They left the sleeping chamber behind Trant Rowan, who led them back down the hall and up the stairs to the cold chamber and the scry waters. Beck held Rue's hand in his own, a reassurance that transcended physical presence and touched on emotional support. He could read her feelings in her touch, in the strength of her grip. He took his cue from those. He spoke with the druid conversationally, asking if there was any news, if the airship searching for his sister and son had returned, if the day seemed a good one. He told Trant Rowan that their sleeping arrangements were more than adequate, better than they had been used to over the past few weeks. He praised the food. He talked to put the other at ease. He talked to calm himself. "Shadea is ready," Trant Rowan advised him as they reached their destination, and Beck understood it to be a warning that he should be ready as well. The cold chamber felt frigid in the wake of the night's recent departure, the chill of the darkness still present. Beck shivered involuntarily as he entered the room, hunching his shoulders against the sudden change in temperature. Shadea Aru stood to one side, looking out the window at the sunrise, her broad shoulders wrapped in a scarlet cloak that fell all the way to the floor. When she turned, he saw that the clasp that fastened it bore the crest of the Druid Order, the instantly recognizable emblem of the Eilt Druin. It flashed brightly as the light caught it momentarily, and Beck thought he caught a reflection of that hard brightness in Shadea's eyes as well. "We are anxious to begin, Beck," she said perfunctorily, nodding to Rue, but not speaking to her. "Are you sufficiently rested now?"
"I am," Beck assured her. "Let's begin."
She beckoned him to stand with her at the basin. Beck moved over to peer down into the swirl of deep green waters, seeing fluctuations on their surface that seemed to have no discernible origin. He studied them for a moment, then glanced at Shadea expectantly. As he did so, he caught sight of Garen Serra, who was standing back and to one side of him in the shadows. He wondered how many more were hiding somewhere in that room. He wondered if he was going to be able to fool them all. "You already understand what it is the Scry Waters do," Shadea said. "If you can use your magic to connect with their impulses, you should be able to reach beyond what is visible for a more comprehensive reading. I am hopeful that your reach will extend the magic that resides in your sister, or perhaps your son. Any little trace, any clue revealed by doing so may prove helpful." Helpful to whom, he thought, but he said nothing, only nodding in response.
"Would you move back from me a little?" he asked.
All of them, Rue included, stepped away from the basin to give him the space he needed. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes in concentration. He calmed himself, centered himself, and then lost himself in the deep silence that settled over the room. He would have only one chance, and if he wasn't convincing enough, he would be in the worst trouble of his life. These were druids, he reminded himself for what must have been the 100th time. Druids weren't easily fooled when it came to the use of magic. On the other hand, none of them possessed or truly understood the magic of the wish song. That was his edge, if he had any. He waited until he could hear himself breathing in the stillness, then summoned the magic. He began with a low humming, a sound that mirrored a wind's whisper as it passed through the branches of the trees, soft and silky. He brought it out of its resting place and let it fill him with warmth. The cold of the room lessened and then disappeared. His concentration was so complete that the people around him disappeared as well. He was alone, lost in himself and in his magic. When he opened his eyes again, he saw only the basin in front of him. He reached out with his hands and let them hover just above the deep green waters, so close he could almost feel the strange ripples that disturbed the otherwise placid surface. He moved his hands, slowly, taking his time, not rushing the flow of the magic from his body. He watched the waters respond as he let the first tendrils stroke their surface. He felt them shudder at the intrusion. He worked more swiftly then, enveloping the scry waters in a broad swath intended to detect any obvious sign of Grian or Pen. The former's presence would reveal itself immediately, so strong was the connection between them. Shadea had been right about that. Their shared use of magic was a powerful link. But nothing showed itself. No sign of his sister surfaced. He kept searching, sending the wish song's magic deep into the scry waters, into the gridwork of the lines of power that crisscrossed the four lands, sifting and probing. He moved his hands in a slow, circular motion that took him in all directions, toward all of the possible places she might have gone. Still, nothing. He was beginning to think that his efforts were a waste of time, a result he did not like to contemplate, when abruptly he touched on something. The surface of the scry waters rippled in response, and he moved his focus away immediately so Shadea would not see. He continued his search in other areas, taking his time, trying to give an appearance of thoroughness. He must seem to be working hard at making the magic connect. He must not appear duplicitous. But it was harder now, because his instincts were to return to the place on the gridwork where he had found what he was looking for. Time slipped away. Nothing further revealed itself. He let his hands sweep back to the point of connection, a testing of his previous discovery. Once again, the scry waters rippled, and he felt the presence of wish song magic. Moving his hands away, he marked the place in his mind, knowing now where to go and what to look for. Then, preoccupied with his discovery and ready to break this off, he let his hands settle over the place on the gridwork that marked Paranor's solitary spires. Instantly, the scry waters boiled and steamed, then exploded in a massive geyser. Magic ripped through Beck, breaking down his defenses and his connection with the basin waters. He was caught completely unprepared, and the next thing he knew, he was flat on his back on the floor, his clothing steaming, and his hair singed. Beck! Rue was at his side, cradling his head in her hands, bent close to his face. He blinked hard, trying to dispel the dizziness that was making the room spin and her voice echo. Had he lost consciousness? How long had he been lying there? "Look at me," she said. "Can you see me? Can you hear what I'm saying?" He nodded wordlessly. Their druid hosts were gathered around him as well, crouched like vultures, faces a mix of hunger and expectation. He had planned to deceive them by creating a diversion with the wish song's magic. He hadn't planned on it happening this way. His entire body throbbed, and his head ached as if he had taken a physical beating. "What did you see?" Shadea demanded of him, her eyes narrowed. "You must have seen something, felt something."
He shook his head. His tongue felt thick in his mouth, and his teeth were gritted against the pain.
"Nothing,"
he mumbled as he worked his jaw muscles, trying to make them relax.
"I don't know what happened. I was working the magic, just a general search. My hands passed over Paranor's location on the map. Then this."
He saw recognition in her eyes, a glint of satisfaction and exultation, a response that suggested she had found what she had been looking for and that it was not something she would ever reveal to him. Then a veiled, guarded look took its place, and she smiled. "You came in contact with the magic that wards the druids keep, Beck. It was a backlash of the protections we set in place for ourselves. Paranor was defending us. I should have warned you. Are you all right?"
"I'll need to rest myself a bit before I try again. I'm not done yet with my search."
"You shall have all the rest you need." She stood up, glancing at the other two. "He has done well for his first attempt. He'll do even better next time. Trant, take our guests back to their rooms. See that they have everything they need while Beck recovers, food and drink and fresh clothing, perhaps a walk in the gardens later. On the morrow, Beck, we will try again." She was gone from the room so quickly that he had no further chance to question her odd response. Still woozy, he drew himself up into a sitting position and hung his head between his knees.
"That was dramatic,"
Rue whispered as she placed his arm over her shoulders and helped him to stand. Trant Rowan had moved ahead to open the door for them and was looking down the hallway after Shadea and Garen Serra.
"Did you intend to hurt yourself like that?"
"I didn't intend to hurt myself at all. If things had gone the way they were supposed to," he whispered back. He saw the look of surprise in her eyes and managed a tired smile.
"I didn't plan any of that."
"What happened then?"
"I don't know. Something I didn't expect. But it wasn't wasted effort anyway."
She leaned close.
"Pendaren?"
He nodded.
"I think I found him."
He fell asleep almost immediately after reaching their bedchamber, too exhausted even to remove his clothes. He slept soundly until Rue woke him to make him eat something, and then he fell right back asleep. He dreamed, but his dreams were disjointed and strange, a collection of images from his past life and from other lives entirely, all connected in a way that made them surreal and unfathomable. He thought he was aware of Rue speaking to him more than once, but it wasn't enough to bring him out of the dreams. When he woke again, the sun was setting. He was alone in the room, a tray of food sitting on the table by his bed. He ate, then washed, and moved over to sit by the window and watch the sun disappear and the moon come up. Stars began to appear in the darkening sky north. It was another half hour before Rue appeared.
"You're awake," she said as she came through the doorway and saw him. "How do you feel?"
"As if I've been thrown off a cliff, but better than I felt earlier. The dizziness is gone, the aching isn't so bad. I expect I'll live. Where were you?"
"Trant Rowan took me for a walk in the Druid Gardens," she smiled. "They really are beautiful, and I would have loved to see more of them. But the walk turned into an inquisition. I spent most of my time fending off questions about Pen. The Druids don't know much about our son, but they seem awfully eager to learn. Too eager." She kept her voice low, moving over to sit beside him on the bench. "On the other hand, I got a good look around. I have a better idea of how to get around than I did before. I thought we might want to know where all the doors and windows are, in case we end up having to get out of here quickly."
She put her arm around him.
"You scared me this morning. Are you sure you're all right?"
He leaned over and kissed her, then put his lips against her ear.
"I've been thinking while you were out," he whispered. thinking about this morning and what happened in the cold chamber. I have some ideas that might be worth considering.
Tell me about Penderyn first,
she insisted, putting her arms around him and drawing him close, her voice a whisper as well. I've been waiting all day for you to be coherent enough to talk to me. You said you found him?
He nodded into her shoulder.
In the Charnel Mountains. It happened too quickly for me to be sure exactly where he is. I couldn't take the time to find out without giving away what I was doing, but it was definitely him.
Why would he be all the way up there?
I don't know. He took a deep breath. Here's what I do know. I was doing a general search through the Scry Waters for any sign of Penn or Grianne. I found Penn in the charnels, like I said, but I moved away from the contact before Shadea or one of the others could tell what I was doing. Maybe they would have known anyway, but I didn't want to chance it. I purposely didn't search Paranor on the grid. After all, that was where Grianne was supposed to have disappeared. What was the point?
A question you might have answered differently if you had stopped to think about it, she said quietly.
He nodded. True enough. Anyway, I worked my way back to Penn to make certain he was in the charnels, that I hadn't made a mistake. Then I moved my hands away again, trying to decide what to do next. I let my concentration lapse, and my hands drifted back down over Paranor. That was when the Scry Waters exploded and threw me away from the basin. Shadea claimed that Paranor's warding magic responded to my intrusion, defending the keep. But I wasn't trying to intrude. I wasn't doing anything threatening. What I was doing was searching for Penn and Grianne, and I think the magic that wards Paranor reacted to that. I think it reacted because I found something it was trying to hide. She was silent a moment.
But it wasn't Penderyn, because he is somewhere in the charnels. So it has to be Grianne.
I think so.
When she disappeared, Tagwyn left Paranor without confiding in any of the druids who might have helped him. I think the key to discovering what happened to my sister lies here, and that these druids who claim to be her friends are covering it up.
But you were brought here to find her. Why would they do that if they are trying to hide where she is?
I think we were brought here to find Penn, and found Grianne by accident. Did you see Shadea's face when I explained what I was doing when the magic threw me back from the Scry Waters? She was elated. I think it confirmed something she already knew about Grianne. It's Penn she's looking for, but she had to tell me to look for my sister, too, because it would have seemed odd not to.
Beck felt her shake her head slowly against his own.
I still don't understand what Penderyn has to do with all this. I still don't see why he's up in the Charnel Mountains, miles from everything.
He didn't make an immediate response. He didn't have the answers to those questions. His instincts told him that Penn was running away, that he had fled Patch Run to avoid capture, perhaps from these druids, perhaps from someone else. What troubled him was that Penn would have come looking for them if he had been able to do so. He wouldn't have run off blindly, and he certainly wouldn't have gone into the charnels without a very good reason. He stared off into the growing dark. Penn was level-headed and capable, but that didn't stop Beck from being frightened for his son. Penn was just a boy, and he lacked the life experience necessary to deal with this sort of danger. If he was being chased, there was always the possibility that he would panic.
Beck. I just thought of something, Rue whispered.
She moved so that they could see each other, her face so close to his that they were almost touching.
If Shadea knows the Wish Song's magic exposed Grianne, she will expect it to expose Penderyn as well. You won't be able to pretend otherwise for long.
He nodded. I thought of that.
We can't allow that to happen. How are we going to prevent it?
He leaned forward and kissed her on the mouth.
While they're sleeping, we're going to use the Scry Waters and find him ourselves.
Chapter 9. Night had fallen across the four lands, and Arisheg was bright with the light of torches and candles when Sen Dunsadan made his way back from dinner to his sleeping chambers. The day had been productive. An address before the Coalition Council had produced a standing ovation following his carefully worded promise that he had found a way to resolve the war on the Preken Doran quickly and favorably. Even those who would have liked to see his role in the Federation government diminished congratulated him afterwards for his courage and commitment. They were counting on him to fail, of course, but he was confident that he wouldn't. This was due in part to an earlier visit to Eton Auric, who had completed all work on the first of what he was now calling his fire launchers. He had mounted it on a swivel that allowed it to swing left and right at a 90-degree firing angle and was equipped with a sighting system and recoil springs to keep it from disrupting the flight of an airship, once it was in place and operating. It was also equipped with controls to manipulate the amount of energy fed through the crystals and released from the mouth of the firing tube. When Sen Dunsadan had tested it this time, the scope of its destructive capabilities had left him breathless with anticipation. His excitement was only marginally diminished by news that no other weapons were yet complete. But after long hours of experimentation using different combinations of crystals, Auric was close to duplicating his first effort and expected to complete a second launcher before the week was out. At the construction site for Federation airships, mercenary rover designers and builders were at work on a huge new flagship, the Dectera, which would carry Sen Dunsadan's secret weapon into battle when she was completed. He inspected their work and was satisfied with their progress. For the first time in a very long time, he could imagine a world dominated by the Federation. His bedchamber was lit with candles, but deeply shadowed in its corners and alcoves when he entered. And he might not have seen her at all had she not immediately moved out into the light to greet him. His heart went directly to his throat in that instant, freezing his muscles and his voice so that he was rendered completely helpless. Then he recognized her, and he gave a quick, sharp sigh. "Iridia," he said. He straightened himself. His composure recovered, and his irritation fanned. "What are you doing here?"
"Waiting for you."
Iridia Ileri stepped forward, her slender body and white skin giving her an almost ethereal look. She was wrapped in a lightweight traveling cloak that hung open to the floor, and her dark hair fell in loose waves about her shoulders. He was captivated, as always, by her impossible beauty. He had not seen her in weeks, not since she had given him the liquid night that he, in turn, had given to Shadea Aru to eliminate Grian Omsford and seize control of Paranor. She had been his spy within the Druid's Keep for some time, but it was not until she had provided the potion that she had proved her real value.
"Waiting for me for what reason?" he demanded.
"It was our agreement that you would remain at Paranor and monitor the activities of our new Ard Ris so that I might have eyes and ears inside the keep. It was our agreement that you would never come here."
The elven sorceress shrugged. "The agreement has been changed." He had never trusted her, never felt comfortable with what she was doing for him. He was more than willing to accept her offer of help and make use of her services as a spy. But she had been close to Shadea for too long for him to feel comfortable with the idea that she was ready to switch loyalties to him. It was one thing to betray Grian Omsford, whom they all hated. It was another to betray a friend. Not that someone like Iridia would ever be bound too closely by friendship. But her machinations confused him. She would not tell him where she had gotten the liquid night. She would not tell him why she had chosen to pass it to Shadea through him rather than to give it to her friend directly. She would not explain her need for secrecy in working with him. Try as he might, he could not figure out what she would gain from all this. That sort of thing tended to bother a man whose life was built around understanding the nature of manipulations.
"You look tired, Sen Dunsadan," she said.
"Are you tired?" He shook his head. I am irritated, Iridia. I don't like surprises, and I don't like people who second-guess my decisions without speaking to me about it first. Why has our agreement been changed? She moved to one of the chairs flanking the windows looking out over the city, and sat down. He could barely see her in the dim light, but he was aware suddenly that something was different about her. I have had a falling out with Shadea, she said. The damage cannot be repaired. She will no longer consult with me on things of any importance. She will seek to diminish me, and ultimately to eliminate me completely. As a result, I cannot be effective as your spy.
A falling out? He repeated.
Of a sort that has nothing to do with our agreement. She does not know about you and me. She does not even suspect. What has caused the breach between us has to do with someone I once cared for, deeply. He had heard rumors about her involvement with another druid, of a love affair that Grian Ormsford had put a stop to. Could this be whom she was talking about? But Shadea had not had anything to do with that business. He couldn't see the connection. So I came here, she finished, reaching for a goblet and pouring wine from the decanter that sat next to it.
You came here to do what?
He moved forward a couple of steps to see her face better in the dim light, still trying to decide what was different about her. She drank deeply of the wine, then set the goblet down and looked at him. I came here to be your personal advisor. If I cannot be effective within the order, then I shall be effective from without. Our agreement still stands, Prime Minister. It has simply been altered. My usefulness must take another form. Since I can no longer spy on the Druid Order, I shall advise you regarding it. I shall give you the kind of advice that no one else will, advice gained from having lived among them, of knowing how they think, of understanding what they will do. No one else can provide this. He hesitated, finding her argument persuasive, but not quite trusting her motives. You need me to tell you what to expect from them, she said. No one knows Shadea Aru better than I do. You have an alliance with her, and with the Order through her, but you need to know how to make use of it. I know how far she will allow herself to be pushed, and in what directions. I know what will persuade her when persuasion is needed. I know her weaknesses far better than you do.
I know her well enough to keep her at bay, he said.
She laughed softly. You know her well enough to get yourself killed. If you think she will honor your agreement once she has no further use for it, you are a fool. She made it to gain credibility for the Order and for herself. She will use you to see the Freeborn smashed and the balance of power shifted, and then she will use you to gain control of the Federation as well. Surely you accept that this is so? In fact, he did. He had known as much all along, although he didn't like thinking about it. He had accepted it as a necessary consequence of his alliance with her because he needed that alliance in order to end the stalemate on the Precandoran. Even with his new weapon, he was wary of the druids, of their power as wielders of magic. What Iridia was telling him was nothing new, but it was making him take a fresh look at the realities.
Your intent is to act as my advisor, he repeated, trying to get used to the idea.
Your druid advisor. Your personal druid advisor. No one else in all the four lands will have one, save you. That will give you a measure of respect that you could gain in no other way. It will give you stature for what needs doing.
You would leave the Order?
She laughed again, and the sound sent a chill up his spine. It wasn't the laugh itself. It was the emptiness it suggested. I have already left the Order. Better to be your advisor in Ereshkigal than a whipping boy in Paranor. Understand me, Sen Dunsedain. I am a sorceress of great power. I was born with it. I was trained to use it. I am the equal of Shadea, though she might not think so. I might have been the equal of Grian Ormsford. I want for myself what you want, recognition and power.
Yours will come with the Federation's victory over the Freeborn. Mine will come when I have replaced Shadea as Ard Rhys. Together, we can make both happen more easily. Accept my offer.
He studied her without speaking. Could she have turned against him and become Shadea's spy? Could this be an elaborate charade, part of a plan to eliminate him? But no. If Shadea wanted him dead, it would be easy enough to make him so. It would not require such a complicated approach. Besides, what use was he to Shadea if he was dead? Another from the Council would simply take his place, and she would risk losing her alliance with the Federation. He could think of no reason she would want that to happen. He folded his arms across his chest. Very well, Iridia. I accept. Your advice would be most welcome. He held up one finger. But I hope this isn't a game you play with me. If I find that it is, I will have you killed without another thought. You might be a druid, but you are still only made of flesh and blood. Her pale face tilted slightly, as if she were seeing a strange animal. Who was it who offered her services to you as your spy in the druid camp? Who was it who told you of a way to dispose of Grian Ormsford without casting suspicion on yourself? Who brought you the Liquid Knight? Who has stood by you every step of the way? Name another besides me. There was a coldness to the challenge that warned him against any answer but one. Your point is well taken. He felt dangerously close to the edge of something he neither understood nor could control. What was it about her that was suddenly so troubling? I shall arrange rooms for you in my home, he added quickly, realizing that he was staring. She didn't seem to notice. She rose and walked to the bedroom door. Do not bother. I will look after myself. I'm used to doing so. Then she turned. When you have need of me, I shall be there. She drew her cloak close about her and was gone. Guards were stationed at the chamber doors, and servants were at work farther down the hallway of the Prime Minister's residence, so the Morrick waited until it was safely alone in an empty room at the back of the house before shedding its clothing and skin. It hated the stench of both, and was anxious to return to the sewers, where it had been in hiding for several days while spying on the human, Dunsadan. When the clothes and skin were removed, it folded them up and stuffed them into a bag under its cloak, strapping the bag over its sleek body. It would not wear them again until the next meeting. By then, it would be better able to bear the smell. Relieved of its disguise and free to depart, it went out the window. It was 3 stories up, but since it had come in by climbing the wall, it had no difficulty leaving the same way. Using its claws to grip the stones, it went down like a lizard, crawling and skittering until it was back on the ground. From there, it scurried across the grounds and through the shadows to the edge of the compound, went over the wall, and faded into the night. It had been in the city for the better part of a week, making itself familiar with its new surroundings. After coming out of the forbidding, it had acted quickly to eliminate the human who had facilitated its crossing, absorbing it as a sponge would water, consuming flesh and bones and blood, but assimilating its memories and traits and keeping the skin to disguise itself. The Morrick was a demon, but it was a changeling as well. While most changelings could only pretend at being other creatures, however, the Morrick could actually devour and become them. It was a useful ability, particularly here in this world, where it would have been quickly noticed otherwise. The woman's death had assured its secrecy, and her skin had given it away out of the druid's safehold. Too many magic users resided there for the Morrick to feel comfortable. It was powerful, but no match for large numbers. Besides, it had taken what it needed from the druids. Misguided and corrupt, they had yielded to the temptations offered them and unwittingly opened the door that imprisoned it.
So desperate were they to indulge their own greed that they had never stopped to think what it was they were really doing. How easily manipulated they had been. First, the woman whose skin it inhabited, then those who shared her hatred of the one human it feared. Had she not been betrayed and sent into the Forbidding to take its place, it would still be locked away in the world of the Jarker Roos. But the cunning and deception of the Straken Lord had deceived them all, and so, for the first time in centuries, a demon was free. Still, it would all be for nothing if the Morrick did not accomplish what it had been sent to do. The human, Dunsidan, was the key. The Morrick hadn't known as much when it came to this city. Its plans not yet fully formed, its intent for the most part to find a way to make use of its human disguise. But yesterday, it had discovered the project the human Dunsidan had sought to keep secret. It had learned of the weapon he had built and the hopes he harbored of using it against other humans. The Morrick had watched as the man in charge played with the crystals. It had watched as Dunsidan used the weapon, burning through thick metal, twisting and destroying entire slabs in seconds. There was something of interest. The human thought to use the weapon as a tool of war. The Morrick was not so short-sighted. The city was sleeping, and the Morrick was able to pass freely down its streets and alleyways. The few humans it encountered never saw it. It climbed the walls or hid in the darkness and waited for them to pass. It could have killed them easily and would have enjoyed doing so, but it was there for a different purpose and would not allow itself to be distracted. Its value lay not only in its adaptability, but also in its single-minded determination. There would be plenty of time for killing humans later, when its task was complete. When it reached the entrance to its hiding place, it glanced around to be certain it was alone before going down through the grates. The smells of the sewer were sweet and welcome, and it hastened to reach the cold, dark catacombs through which they tunneled. It was the one place in that wretched world that reminded it of its own. It could feel at peace there. It could find comfort. One day, it promised, everything would be just like that. The darkness was thick and deep beneath the earth within the tunnels, and the Morrick found a shelf submerged in several inches of fetid water and sewage, and settled down to sleep. Chapter 10. They were still miles away when Grian saw the fortress for the first time. It sat on a plateau that fell away hundreds of feet from a huge mountainside. Silhouetted against the empty horizon, black and stark within a swirling mix of gray mist and low-hung clouds, the fortress's towers and parapets jutted sharp and hard-edged from the mottled rock as if they had blossomed like a cancer. It was a huge, sprawling complex. She stared at it from the bed of straw on which she lay, her chains clanking softly as she rolled and swayed with the pitch of the wagon in which she was caged. They were moving in the direction of the fortress, and she felt certain that it was their destination. Whoever had made her a prisoner would be waiting there. She contemplated what that might mean as the strange caravan rolled on, the bull beasts snorting and huffing from their exertions, the wolves surging past in flashes of gray ruff and snarling muzzles, the creaking of iron-bound wheels and leather harness mingling with the staccato snapping of whips and the odd croaking of wagon drivers she could not see. Dust filled the air, thick and choking, and she smelled its dryness and age. It made her choke, and she buried her face in her shoulder to breathe. Her body ached from being shackled, and her head throbbed from the ingestion of grit and the stench of the animals. Once, when she was looking in the right direction, she saw the strange creature that seemed in charge of the little procession, its oddly elongated face peering in at her, top knot of coarse black hair swaying with its steps,
bearded face intense and bright-eyed with interest. It did not speak to her as it had the first time it had approached, merely studied her a moment before moving on. Exhausted and sick at heart, she dozed for a time, and when she woke again, they were climbing a long, winding ramp that led to the fortress. It looked even bigger by then, looming up in a cluster of peaked roofs and crenellated walls, blacker than the soot of a wet fire and sharper-edged than a throwing knife. She sat up, bracing herself against the pitch and roll of the wagon, looking up the rampway to where a pair of massive, iron-bound gates had opened to admit them. Creatures that reminded her of Wake a Dart in the way they carried themselves scurried about on the tops of the walls and along the ramp itself, the metal of their weapons and armor glinting dully. The fortress was heavily defended, whoever its lord, and the only approach seemed to be up the fully exposed ramp. She was reminded suddenly of Tirsis, Callahorn's great fortress in the Four Lands. This keep could be a mirror of that one, and she suspected that it was situated on the same plateau in this world as Tirsis was in her own. The similarities surprised her, and yet she knew that in the divergence of separate histories, some things would work out much the same. The use of geography in choosing natural positions of defense would surely be one. The gates swallowed them up and closed behind them with a booming sound. Then there were faces all around her, sharp-featured and hungry-looking, fringed in coarse hair and dominated by flat noses and pointed ears. Goblins, she realized, though she had never seen one. They had been banished into the Forbidding in the time of Faerie, she had read in the Druid histories. Some of them grinned unpleasantly, revealing sharp, pointed teeth and black gums. They reached through the bars to touch her. The wolves snarled and snapped angrily at them, as if protecting a meal they would soon enjoy. The drivers she couldn't see flicked their whips and croaked. The air was filled with raucous sounds and fetid smells and, even inside the walls of the keep, clouds of dust. The caravan rolled to a halt at a central tower, one ringed with walls that were spiked and barbed atop their parapets, and through which the mouths of spear launchers protruded like serpent tongues. A flurry of activity announced their arrival as dozens more of the goblins surrounded the wagons, some bearing lengths of rope and chain attached to slip nooses and clamps, and some bearing weapons. Grian could no longer hear the snarls of the wolves. Presumably, the huge beasts had been locked outside the last wall they had passed through, their task as herders complete. The creature with the topknot reappeared, coming out of the goblin throng to unlock and open the door to her cage. She stood quietly as her keeper entered, thinking that if it got close enough, she might break its neck. But it kept its distance once inside, staying just out of her reach, working instead on the chains that held her fast, releasing them one at a time from the cage walls and passing the ends over to groups of goblins waiting to receive them. It all seemed well rehearsed and smoothly accomplished, and she was given no opportunity to resist. So she remained calm and let them do what they chose. She could wait. Her gag was left in place, and her irons kept locked as she was led down out of the wagon. She was aware that her jailers held the chains taut so that she could be yanked over quickly if she tried to make a sudden move. It seemed clear to her that any effort at reaching for the gag in her mouth would trigger such a response. She couldn't know if they were aware of the wish song's power and so were keeping her gagged because of it, or if they were simply warding against the possibility of her employing any combination of utterances and gestures that might trigger an onslaught of magic. She glanced once at the drivers of the wagons and found them to be creatures that resembled huge toads, perched on their seats with their hind legs tucked under them, short forearms gripping the reins to the bull beasts, wide-mouthed heads hunched forward, lidded eyes fixed and staring. They made no move to climb down off the seats.
They gave no indication that they had any interest at all in what was happening around them. She saw that the cages ahead of and behind her were empty. She was the only object of transport. The creature with the topknot appeared directly in front of her, its strange face blank and its flat eyes staring. It beckoned for her to follow, and she was assisted by the goblins, who tugged none too gently on her chains to let her know what was required, allowing her to move, but keeping her just the other side of being off balance. She straddle-walked after and through them, doing what was required of her, biding her time because that was all she could do. Ahead of her, massive doors opened to the outer wall of the tower they had drawn up to, and she was led inside. The wall was several feet thick, and its doors were cross-braced with massive timbers and iron bars. Inside, the courtyard was barren and empty of life, a killing ground between the first wall and a second of equally imposing girth. Murder holes overlooked the entryway from walls and gatehouses on both sides. Topknot walked ahead, moving toward a second set of doors. The goblins followed, half dragging her with them. The second set of doors opened into a large room ablaze with torchlight. A single stairway wound down out of the darkness ahead. It was the only other entry into the room. The air was cool and damp, and slicks of water shimmered on the floor and stained the walls. Chains hung from iron rings all about the room. At its center sat a chair similarly equipped. A torture room, Grion decided, and she shivered involuntarily. At Topknot's direction, the goblins moved her over to one wall, spread her legs and fastened her ankle irons to rings embedded in the stone. Then, a heavy leather belt was cinched tightly about her waist, and her wrists were chained to rings in the belt so that she could not lift her arms more than a few inches on either side. Her mind raced. Had they brought her all this way just to kill her? Did they plan to torture her for information? She closed her eyes momentarily, and when she opened them again, the goblins were on their knees. Topknot had gone into a deep bow, and the Lord of the Keep was coming down the stairway. She knew it for a demon right away, though not one she recognized. It was big, taller than she was, and broad through the shoulders. It walked upright like a man, and in general was proportioned as one, though the resemblance ended there. Its skin was black and spiky, with clusters of spines sticking out everywhere except its face, which was flat and devoid of expression. Its features buried so completely that at first glance it seemed possessed only of cold blue eyes that fixed on her with glittering intensity. It wore no clothes, but an assortment of bladed weapons was strapped about its body, some shaped in ways she had never seen. In one hand, it carried a strange collar. When it got to within 10 feet, it stopped and held out the collar. Topknot appeared as if by magic to take it, walked over to Grion, and fastened it securely about her neck. Once it was in place, the angular creature looked back at its master.
"What you wear is called a conjure collar," said the demon that had brought it.
To her surprise, it spoke in a language she recognized.
"If you attempt to use your magic, it will cause you sufficient pain to make you wish you hadn't. If you disobey me in any way, it will punish you. Nod, if you understand me."
She nodded. Topknot removed the gag. She coughed and spit to rid herself of the dryness and dust that were in her throat. Topknot studied her thoughtfully, then released the ankle chains as well.
"Get down on your knees and bow to me," the demon said.
She wasn't sure she had heard right, and she stared in disbelief. The expressionless face looked away, and one clawed hand gestured languidly. Excruciating pain exploded all through her, radiating out from the collar like strands of barbed wire into her throat, her body, and her limbs. She screamed at the assault, unable to stop,
Clutching herself, she dropped to her knees and lowered her head toward the demon.
"You will speak only when told to," it said. "Nod if you understand."
She nodded at once. The conjure collar no longer tore at her, but the pain lingered in small waves that rose and fell with every breath she took. She gasped with the effort required to endure it.
"When you speak to me, you will address me as Master. Nod if you understand."
She nodded.
"Would you like some water? You may answer."
Her jaw clenched in fury.
"Yes, Master."
"Give her water, Hobstool."
The demon's mouth was a thin, lipless opening on the lower half of its flat, empty face. Its voice was raw and hoarse, suggestive of damage sustained by its vocal cords. There was no tonal inflection or hint of emotion. Topknot brought her a cup filled with water that tasted of metal and smelled of swamp, but she drank it anyway. When she was finished, he backed away at once. She looked around. The goblins had faded away. She was alone with Hobstall and the Master of the Keep.
"Do you know where you are?"
the latter asked.
"You may answer."
She nodded. The demon waved dismissively, and pain ratcheted through her once more, dropping her into a fetal position where she lay moaning and sobbing. The demon studied her impassively, then came forward a step.
"Answer me as you have been taught. I want to hear you speak the words you were told to speak."
She squeezed her eyes shut against her humiliation and rage, fighting to keep from breaking down completely.
"Yes, Master,"
she whispered.
"Do you know where you are? You may answer."
"Inside the Forbidding, Master."
She opened her eyes again and looked up.
"Inside the world of the Jarkarus,"
the demon corrected softly.
"Where I brought you to live."
She barely heard it. Her head was buzzing with the after effects of the conjure caller's pain. The demon beckoned to Hobstool, who moved to fill the water cup once more, then hauled her to her knees so that she could drink again of the foul-tasting water. She accepted his gift wordlessly.
"You may thank me."